My name is Julie Tai, and I am the Director of Chapel at Fuller Theological Seminary. Welcome to Fuller Studios' audio stream of sermons drawn from campus chapels and preachers throughout our extended community.
The last time I was reduced to 20 minutes for a sermon, I was in Episcopal Church, and they gave me 12 minutes. And I told them I grew up Baptist, and he said, "You can have 13, but not a minute more." A student in one of my classes sitting at the back, a male student, says aloud, we were talking somehow the subject of hell come up, and the student says, "I believe in hell because I believe in justice." And from the other side of the room, a female student says, "I don't believe in hell because I believe in justice." And I know you can appreciate the tension and the dilemma of the reality of those questions. And so you would not be surprised for me to tell you that a student came in my office one day and said, "Is it true that the traditional Christian belief is that people who have not received Christ into their heart will go to hell?" I said, "I think that's a fair characterization of the traditional view, especially if you want to do it damage." And she said, "So would the traditional people believe that almost everybody in North Korea would go to hell because they've never even had a chance to hear the gospel?" And I said, "You're doing damage." "Yes," I said, "I think a lot of people really believe that." And she says, "I could never believe in a God like that." Good question. Good opportunity for instruction. This is a very, very serious issue. So serious, I doubt that it's ever talked about in Fuller Chapel. Because it's not talked about in very many churches. We don't want to talk about hell because it's a subject that makes us far too uncomfortable. But when Rob Bell talked about it, people got interested. Too interested. But he was asking the right questions for the right audience. And we were all trying to figure out, what's my view of hell? What's my position on eschatology? And Rob Bell was trying to speak to people who are really struggling with these issues of hell. So people immediately exploded into the internet, and now books are reviewed, and within a month the conversation's over and we move on to something else. And publishers try to replicate those things and try to get mean bloggers to get mad at books because it sells books. So I asked my students right after the Rob Bell, what do you believe about hell? Are you a traditional person who believes that you have to receive Jesus Christ into your heart in a conscious way through some kind of prayer or something like it in order to go to heaven, that everybody else is going to hell? And I have students who believe that. And I have a lot of students who struggle with that. Or perhaps have you studied more and you adopt a position called annihilationism, that people who are punished by God, still largely the same game, people who have to receive Christ, but their punishment will not be eternal in that sense of a conscious torment, but instead they will be extinguished from existence. And so we play this game, and other people come along with powerful arguments, and they appeal to Karl Barth, mostly incorrectly. And they say, "I'm a universalist." And they offer arguments, and there are 13 texts in the New Testament. My students know all these texts. That Christ draws all people to himself. What does all mean other than all to a plain reader of the Bible? And Romans 5 says, as one person died and made sin, so Christ made all alive. That's salvific language in the Bible. But what does all mean? Calvinists can torture that word and get it not to mean all. And Arminians don't want it to mean all either. They want to elevate free will. So what's our position? We debate these issues. And then someone comes along like Clark Pinnock, and he says, there's a wideness in God's mercy, a real wideness. And he's called an inclusivist. And usually people who use that term are using it pejoratively and negatively of theologians who they think are on a slippery slope toward universalism. But it has a long history in the church of thinking. And then Rob Bell comes along and he flirts with universalism. He's not a certain universalist, but what he did do is say that God is so loving that God will never not be loving, so that even after death, there will be opportunities for respond to the gospel. Now, this is not very typical among evangelicals, and it really pushes against exclusivism and the traditional view, but it's not unknown in the history of the church. And people want to know, well, maybe I could believe that. And finding texts to support that are very difficult. And I have plenty of students who are just raw pluralists. They cannot understand how God could send North Koreans to hell, how they could send Buddhists to hell, and all those Muslims they hear about on TV, usually from the wrong side. So we ask these questions. These are serious questions, and we want to know the answers to these questions. And so my students come to me and say, what's the answer? And on this question, they don't want the book of Revelation. They don't want Paul. They want to know if Jesus said something about this. Because if he didn't, well, then maybe Paul just got a little over the edge at times. And maybe Revelation, after all, it's apocalyptic. You can't trust that stuff. So they want to know what Jesus says. And so I want to read to you a parable from Jesus. And I don't want you to open your Bibles. And I don't want you to pull out your iPhones and read it. Or your iPads. The parables of Jesus were meant to be heard, not to be read. So I'll read them to you. And I'll give a little midrash as we go along. It's not in the parable, but it's right. So that's why I'll bring those things up. And I'm going to run out of time. There was a rich man, and this is in red letters, and I'm old enough that I have a really hard time seeing red letters in my Bible. So I've pleaded with Zondervan to come up with a Bible that's readable for old people. There was a rich man who was dressed in purple. Now, this is a trope. I mean, right now we got a nice story. A rich man dressed in royal clothing, fine linen, and he lived in luxury every day. At his gate was laid a beggar named Lazarus, of course. That first century Galilean audience picked up on this name. Lazarus means God helps. Covered with sores and longing to eat what fell from the rich man's table. Maybe, probably, referring to the bread that rich people used to wipe off their hands at the end of a meal, and they tossed it on the floor for dogs and animals. And the poor man would just, it would be nice to eat the bread that the rich man used to wipe his hands with at the end of the meal. There's a little flavor there. There's some sustenance. Even the dogs came and licked the man's sores. It's a pretty gruesome scene. He's got your attention and everybody's listening to Jesus. The time came when the beggar died and the angels carried him to Abraham's side. That's a bit of a shocker. The rich man also died, and he was buried. The poor man didn't get buried. His body was just left to rot in public for everybody to see. But the rich man enjoyed what rich people get to have, nice burials. And we've got a nice story going here. In Hades, where the rich man was in torment, he looked up and he saw Abraham far away with Lazarus by his side, so he called to him, Father Abraham, have pity on me and send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue because I am in agony in this fire. And Abraham is not like Mr. Rogers. He says, pretty stiffly, Son, Remember that in your lifetime you received your good things while Lazarus received bad things, but now he's comforted here and you are in agony. And besides all this, between us and you, a great chasm has been set in place so that those who want to go from here to you cannot, nor can anyone cross over from there to us. Well, the man's not giving in. I beg you, Father, send Lazarus to my family, for I have five brothers. Let him warn them so that they will not also come to this place of torment. Abraham's not backing down. They have Moses and the prophets. Let them listen to them. No, Father Abraham, if someone from the dead goes to them, they will repent. And he said at the end, if they don't listen to Moses and the prophets, they will never be convinced, even if someone rises from the dead. So there you go. I read this parable to my students, and there's his answer to your question. Let me make a few distinctions as we go here. I want to make sure I don't run out of time. Hades is probably not a permanent place. Jesus is trading in Jewish folklore, but the cosmology is rich. It's consistent in Judaism. And perhaps Jesus actually believes these categories that he's using actually portray the afterlife. Hades is a temporary place. According to Revelation, it is thrown into the lake of fire along with death. So maybe Hades is a temporary prison, as the Old Testament calls Sheol, for the wicked. Then, in the Bible, hell would be describing as a trope of the valley south of Jerusalem. It describes the final place of destruction and judgment. That would mean that Abraham's bosom perhaps is a prison holding place for good people. Maybe they're waiting till the end of judgment to be ushered into the age to come, Olam Haba, or the eternity and heaven. And then this parable teaches very clearly that there's a great chasm between Hades and Abraham. And Jesus offers very strong words that it's uncrossable. This looks like there's no second chance. And I wonder what Rob Bell thinks about that. And my students wonder what he thinks about that. And they know. I tell them, go read his book. He talked about it. But it seems like Jesus is talking about that issue. But even more, he says that the witness of Moses and the prophets is adequate, that the preaching of the gospel is all people do. If they don't respond to that, then clearly there's no need for any more special revelation for those people. Well, we then look in class at this parable and we ask, which side is Jesus on? Which one of those six terms would Jesus fasten on? And we think we've got this figured out. And then I tell my students this, you know, I think we've been reading this parable the wrong way the whole time. I think we want this parable to tell us whether we're right in our beliefs. But we make this trick because we identify with the wrong character in the parable. You know something? You and I are not the poor man. The poor man goes to heaven. What happens to the rich man? This is a parable about rich people. How many of you, when you got up this morning, asked, will there be anything to eat? Didn't you ask, what will I choose to eat? You didn't ask if there would be something to drink. You chose whether it would be skim, whether it would be latte, macchiato, or just ordinary drip coffee for the ordinary poor people of this world who haven't yet moved into the upper echelons of coffee tasting. In California, people don't ask what to eat at dinner or what to drink at dinner. They ask which vineyard, which grape, which year. You didn't ask this morning if you had something to write with. You have something to write with. And you might have many things to write with. I have a $400 fountain pen in my pocket. I like my fountain pens. Sort of like Gollum's ring. I always have it with me. and it brings me comfort. And I have 15 of these fountain pens. I didn't ask if I would have shoes. I asked which shoes I would wear. I didn't ask if I would have clothing. I asked which clothing I would wear. We are the rich people. This is a parable that says to you, how do you treat the Lazarus at your gate? Because it says we're the rich people, unless you're the poor people, and we're not. We're destined to hell and Hades in this parable if we don't respond to the Lazaruses in our world. This parable deconstructs our response to books like Rob Bell's, doesn't it? Because we had sort of a prurient interest in deciding who was the most orthodox evangelical in America and who could stand up for hell the tallest. But that's not why Jesus talked about hell. He warned people morally about what life meant and the significance of how we live in this world. But Jesus was most concerned in this parable with how we respond to the Lazaruses of our world. And so this parable turns inside out. It doesn't ask us which is the right view. It asks us who is living right. Not what's the good view, but who is good. The good person is the person who responds to Lazarus at his gate or at her gate and invites them in. One of my students, who now works with Jim Wallace in Washington, D.C., in a class I was teaching where I first developed an idea called the Jesus Creed, came to me in April and said, I have been coming to North Park for 2 years and walking down the street, and I have walked by homeless people, and it wasn't till in the morning I began to recite the Jesus Creed when I got out of bed, just as you told me. He was working for extra credit. He said that I became aware that there were actually homeless people that I was walking by, and I've gotten to know them, and I want to do something about it. And so students, we're going to spend a night outside in April. This isn't Southern California. This is Chicago. And he said, we've committed not to wearing a coat, not to having blankets, not to having pillows, no sleeping bags. We want to express solidarity with the homeless of Chicago. The next year, Tim King was invited by the G8 conference to come to England to discuss what university students in the United States are doing for the homeless. And Tim King graduated from North Park, a 4.0 student in philosophy and theology, and he was offered a PhD scholarship study program at Duke with Stanley Hauerwas, or to work with the homeless in Chicago. And so he came to my office and he said, which should I do? And I said, Tim, to quote Jesus, the poor you will always have with you. Go to Duke. A week later, Tim came to my office. He said, I'm staying in Chicago and I'm working with the homeless. For 3 years, he came to my office every now and then to talk about the homeless in Chicago. And then Jim Wallace snarfed him up and brought him to Washington, D.C. And Tim is his right-hand man because Lazarus was at his gate, and he saw him. Do you see the Lazarus at your gate, or do you walk by? That's what this parable is about. To hell with our discussions about hell. We need to respond to the Lazarus at our gate. May God, in his mercy, awaken us to Lazaruses at our gate.
You have been listening to a production of Fuller Studio. Fuller Studio provides articles, podcasts, videos, and other resources for a deeply formed spiritual life. Subscribe on your favorite podcast app or visit us at fuller.edu/studio.